Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. And today we're exploring the story of the most famous nightclub in the world, Studio 54. Why are we talking about it now? Well, Studio 54 is the subject and title of a new feature-length documentary out now. And to discuss the glitz and glamour of its dance floor today, I'll be joined in the studio by the film critic Jason Solomons and the DJ Severino Panzetta. When two college friends, Ian Schrager and Steve Rebell, took over an old TV studio in Manhattan to turn it into a nightclub, surely they couldn't have known just how world-changing it was going to be. Studio 54 was the hot ticket of the late 1970s, where you could rub shoulders with supermodels, rock stars and the leading lights of Hollywood, as well as people from all different backgrounds. Black, white, gay, straight, men in women's clothes, women in men's clothes, people in no clothes. And inevitably, Andy Warhol. Sometimes you might be sharing the dance floor with a zebra, sometimes a troupe of acrobats, and due to its high demand, it became the most exclusive, inclusive nightclub in New York. You wouldn't be turned away for not having money, being gay, or coming from the wrong side of the tracks, but you might be denied entry for not having enough joie de vivre.
It was an experience, touching like pretty much all of your senses.
But the party was to be short-lived. After just a couple of years of success, its two owners were arrested for skimming $2.5 million off the door, and a legal battle ensued that landed them in jail. This summer, a new documentary by the filmmaker Matt Turnauer has been released, telling the story of the club and all of its wild associations and famous attendees. Bianca Jagger on a white horse, Diana Ross serenading Schrager and Rubel the night before they went to jail, and the rumour that money was hidden in the ceilings. It's very simply called Studio 54, and it sounds a little like this.
Sex was in the air.
There were mattresses in the basement.
The amount of drugs was profound.
Everyone felt like they had to be there.
The people started to get angrier because they couldn't get in.
You can't have this much popularity without somebody wanting to take it down.
All of a sudden, the lights went on. The police were there. It was like the reality was in your face.
The basement had bags of cash and drugs.
The feds,
mafia,
the White House.
They definitely messed with the wrong people.
Jason and Sev, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Difficult not to smile through that trailer reel there. all the kind of hyperbole and superlatives associated with Studio 54. Jason, as a film, we'll come on to the kind of legend of the club itself. But as a film, as a documentary, how does it stand up? It's tough not to do sort of hagiography, isn't it?
Yeah, how does it stand up? Well, it made me want to stand up and dance, which is the right thing in a cinema.
It's a tick in a box.
It's a funky documentary. Yeah. Whether it's true or not is the other thing. I mean, it says it goes straight to the horse's mouth. In fact, Ian Schrager, who founded the club, is your main narrator for this. I'm not sure he's the most reliable of narrators. I think there's a sort of bit of obfuscation, a bit of mythologizing as well. I mean, New York had a fantastic disco scene at the time. I'm not even sure that Studio 54 was the epicenter of the disco scene. I mean, if you think about Paradise Garage and The Loft and Le Jardin, maybe the music was better there, maybe it was cooler there, maybe it was blacker and gayer there. But Studio 54, clearly from this film, was the one that took all the media attention, was told by the winners. It had Truman Capote, it had Andy Warhol. Yeah. The scribes went there, the posh people went there, as well as the kind of, you know, slightly edgy people, the stars were there. So it was the one that grabbed the spotlight. And I suppose in disco, that's kind of where that's where you live the most, you know, in the glitter of the spotlight. And that's what we clearly get from the archive here, which is tremendous, the kind of print kind of press that they were using, the news footage that you get, which was mainly outside, because that's what the rumour from Studio 54 seemed to be, that you couldn't get in, and that applied to the news crews too. So they were outside watching people not getting
good
in.
PR. Very natural PR from
exactly.
Steve Rebell,
so I think
guess.
Whether it was the best disco night, I don't know. I listened to a lot of Larry Levand from the Paradise Garage. Sounds a lot cooler, sounds better. Maybe the DJs were better. Yeah. But you had disco, and Studio 54 seems to have grabbed it. And this film adds to that mythology, adds to the mythology of the time and place, of New York being all sort of steam coming up from the, you know, yeah, all the mean streets and the taxi driver, Travis Bickle. I can imagine Travis Bickle picking someone up and dropping them off at Studio 54 and not quite knowing, you know. It's that kind of era is going on. And I think that this film sort of captures that a bit. I'd have liked a bit more truth from someone. I'd have liked a bit more music. I'd like to have known who was DJing and why disco was so good and why it worked and why it died. But it doesn't go there. It's about Ian Schrager and his friendship with Steve Rebell. It's almost a bromance, you know.
Yeah, there is some of that. There is some of that. And it's nice, I suppose, you get the story of them coming from, actually, you know, middle-class homes in Brooklyn.
They say working-class Brooklyn. Yeah. And they were kind of street-fighting Jewish kids, although I don't think Steve Rebell would be much good in a street fight.
he'd be holding Ian's coat, possibly.
Checking it and charging for it.
Yeah, exactly. Jason raises a really interesting point there with you'd like to know more about the music. As a DJ, Sev, we know all the tracks. We know there was so much Chic, so much Nile Rodgers, so much Diana Ross on the soundtrack to this film, and indeed in the club there. Well, how do you rate it actually on that sliding scale of great clubs, of the dawn of disco, the definitive disco place? Do you want a bit more music in there?
As you said, like Paradise Garage is definitely more cool at the music, and you know, like what we do as a Horse Me Disco, we have been inspired highly from Larry Levan, which is kind of like the god of all DJs out there.
Yeah.
Studio 54, exactly. It was the right balance of like keep it fun, like little slight commercial. But the music in the soundtrack is exactly like, as you said as well, like it makes you dance. It's very positive, very New York, like all of those like lots of strings and orchestras, you know, you can hear. That's like, it fascinates me to see all the kids nowadays like really into disco again, because like they when they hearing they listen to this music, like, oh my god, this is a popular like, instruments, you know, like there's an orchestra, like that's why it was cost make an album so much money by them, because it was like you had to rent all of these musicians, vocals, singer, da da da,
strings.
I mean, nowadays, they were like popular. I remember actually when I was a kid, like for me, it was amazing learning English and trying to like understand like keyboard, strings, string section, strings 1, 2, 3. Like, oh my god, it's probably like 30 pieces of orchestra make one song, you know. So, like, nowadays, completely like, you know, with your computer, like people they make it in their bedroom. So, like, yeah, I think the soundtrack is actually very good. And I was really honored when I was at Sundance for the main opening, like,
So this was the premiere of this movie at Sundance, right?
Yeah. So I met all of them. I mean, also like, yeah, this woman that like she was in, she compiled all the track listing, because you know, like by then, like when the resident DJs died, I unfortunately. Well, he left all the record collections, so that was quite amazing. Like, so
that is a kind of a holy grail.
Yeah, that's a really good story. Yeah. Well.
Because like, even if he was, as we said, like not a cooler, you know, like music spot, but still, you know, like. Yeah, it was one of those typical places, like, yeah, people were going because other people that were going, you know, to try to see celebrities or stuff. I mean, the music was important, but, you know, not so important, like, again, like, to go to Paradise Garage to see Larry Levan or, like, The Loft or, like, other places. I mean, obviously, there were a bunch of lots of really good DJs in New York, because New York has always been, like, you know, like that. But, yes, that's for sure.
I love the thought of Severino learning English via disco. Yeah. And sort of so everyone is walking around going, you make me feel material.
And then I was going with my cover, with my album, like, my mix, like, to my mom, like, oh, what does it mean, this? What does it mean? Like, Saturday night fever. So night, it means notte, fever, febbre, Saturday, sabato. Yeah, right. You know, like, so like, I kind of like learn sort of English like that.
How do you say, don't leave me this way?
Non lasciarmi in questo modo.
See, it's so good.
Is
you're right. Sev
like
is the man
English,
that was
Italian, like, you know.
learnt to English through the medium of disco and funk. And also, we're recording this program, I should say, at midday. Normally, of course, contractually obliged to walk in a cloud of his own dry ice, but not this morning. Thanks for letting us off the hook there.
No, it's okay.
On the subject of Studio 54.
He's got a white horse outside.
Yeah, I came by my horse from Kingston.
What about the Talking Heads? Because I quite like that. When I interviewed Matt Turnauer and Ian Schrager for the magazine a couple couple of weeks ago about this, and he said he was very keen on having on wanting to do something about the structure of New York and what it meant for New York at the time. And he did that wonderful film Citizen Jane, one film before this, which was about sort of town planning, very sexy.
Yes, I think I talked about that on your show.
Yeah, you came in to talk about it,
and
they're not too dissimilar in the sense of what these places mean for the city.
He did Valentino before that as well, The Last Emperor. So he is interested in the sort of how a figurehead and a person can create an empire within its kind of confines, or fight for one.
And the sort of nuts and bolts of glamour in a weird
way. And how you build your story as well, I think. I mean, he uses, you know, cuttings here a lot. He uses cuttings from the fashion floor for Valentina. Citizen Jane was very much about local newspapers, the Greenwich, the Village Voice, I think it was, and those kind of architecture books. And this is definitely about how the heartbeat of a town, I think, and how to try to capture a moment in time. And as you say, it was very fleeting. 33 months, they say in the documentary. Yeah. I'm not even sure it was a full 33, because I think Schrager and Rebell went away for a bit. Well, go to jail.
They had their license. They had their liquor license constantly revoked, because they only had a temporary kind of one that you'd have if you were setting up a one night like party for it.
That's the inspirational bit, isn't it? Really, the bit where they try and set up the club and say, "Right, we're going to do this," because Rebell had a steak. Chain of steakhouses that hadn't worked. And I love seeing the menu of that, which was very kind of, you know, prawn cocktail, bottle of plonk, and T-bone steak. And Schrager had tried bits and pieces to get this thing together. Was very inspirational. I didn't know all of how they kind of requisitioned people from the theatre to do the lighting as well. It was very much let's put on a show. And that was very much what Studio 54 was about. And I think maybe Paradise Garage and the Loft were more, let's get dancing, let's take our top off, let's get sweaty. This was about the show.
This was kind of Hollywood production.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, because it's still nowadays still the same situation, like in some clubs, like, oh, I can't get here, like selection, VIP, celebrity. I mean, after 40 years, we still...
It's the same prerogative. Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah.
I don't know if they had a VIP room at Studio 51. They sort of say they didn't. You could rub shoulders with Mick Jagger. I'm not sure that's the case.
I think maybe the VIP was their office, you know. I like that scene where Michael Jackson was there. That's amazing.
Isn't it? Yeah. Michael Jackson.
So good.
Young Michael Jackson, completely innocence, like on a corner, like, oh my God.
And it was funny, because Steve Rebell was sitting in his office chair, and Michael Jackson had to sort of come in and sort of squat on the floor next to him.
By
the
bin.
The power dynamic was that way round in those days.
There is a great bit where Ron Galella, who's this famous paparazzo, about whom there's documentaries about him, he's the street photographer of New York at the time, and he goes and he gets his box of, this is my Studio 54 box, and he goes through the photos of it. Yeah. Now that really is... That captures that time, because it's kind of Ouija kind of lit, like kind of that kind of interior is done. He's the pap of the time, and he goes on, here's Stallone and here's Elton John, and you really get a feel of what it was like to kind of prowl about that night in New York, and the celebrity night.
And there was no iPhone, no mobile phone to take pictures by then.
No,
we talked about that. And when I interviewed them both a couple of weeks ago, I don't think, Matt Turner, I said, I don't think you could do this again. And Schrager was like, well, I think you could even with iPhones, even with no zero privacy for people. I think there is what you could still do it. Maybe I couldn't do it, but it could still be done.
You're right. I mean, look, Sev did Horse Meat Disco. Yeah. London had a wonderful. The McQueen documentary was out recently, and they showed that sort of clubbing era that McQueen kind of captured slightly and wrote. So he actually
used to come to us to our place as well.
It all comes together, Sev. And you know that London had this explosion of nightclubs as well in the 90s, that you could do a Turnmills doc, or you could do you know. So clubs have their own mythology; they live on it, and I think maybe that whole club culture since owes something to Studio 54 about promotion and about kind of seizing your moment and kind of defining it within the confines of your walls.
And it's funny, I think, hotels and restaurants seem to have learned a lot from this, but clubs, it seems so difficult to do it these days with clubs. We learn about clubs from documentaries and kind of an LP compilations and stuff rather than going to them. It does seem like that. It's a strange
thing.
There's
still some places, like obviously, you know, one of the main is like in Berlin, Berka, and it's still this place where you can take picture, they're very severe about it. And actually the people, they respect that. They're like, okay, let's sleep. They go, they stay there for days, like now. And and he's got this sort of like sense of, I don't know, just like, and you just remember, like, you know, like, but there are still some places, but it's difficult, as you said. Like,
if you look at London or somewhere like Annabelle's, which has a club, which people say, oh, that's a legendary nightclub in London. I mean, it's just not the coolest nightclub. It never has been, but it's the one that the people who write about that sort of thing in Tatler and Vanity Fair go to. So it's your Graydon Carter kind of place.
Yeah.
So they kind of write about, oh my God, we had a wonderful night. Whereas, you know, there are...
I got a residency in Lulu. I was DJ Lulu last night. So like, right. like So, come and see. But like, yeah, you can allow to take picture and Lulu's as well. But yeah, like, it's the same situation.
Exactly. Right. So where have you been, Sev, that is like... that could possibly get that studio for that mix of hedonism, that mix of race?
I don't know, like, because yeah, the moment everything's changed. I mean, like, New York is very amazing. Like, you know, we got residency there, we go every month. Like, there's still people I completely believe, like, old school, like Susan Bash and Amanda Lepore. They do, Susan, she's still promoting and doing parties every Tuesday and on top of the bar, the rooftop of the Standard Hotel in Meatpacking. Mm. And it fascinates me because she's so old school. She's kind of like, Studio 54.
Like, oh, that sounds like still... a date. That sounds like a date.
I'll see you in June.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. See you boom, boom. Like, it's every Tuesday, like, because like, she's got so many amazing drag queen or whatever, but like, people at old school and they go out on a Tuesday night. That actually like, makes me think London at the moment, midweek as well, is not really so active like New York.
Okay, everyone's
New York
is easier.
Yeah. Yeah, but New York is easier also. Like, it's more compact. I mean, it's a bigger city, but like Manhattan, like, is easier to travel around. Like, in 50 minutes, you are everywhere in a taxi or whatever. Right. London, we are more spread out. But like, on a Tuesday night in a hotel, like, and Susan Bach, you know, she's been around from the 70s, probably actually. Maybe no, maybe not, but like, she couldn't be one of those easy person to go inside Studio 54.
We've kind of chewed the fat of the documentary and of the legend of Studio 54. We're going to play a little clip of an interview I did a couple of years ago with Ian Schrager for a series called The Big Interview, which is on Monocle 24. And I asked him what the defining nights at the club were like.
I always used to like the Halloween parties the best. It's so funny. I think Studio 54's Halloween party had a lot to do with creating it as such a big event. This was before the Village Parade, and I think the Village Parade happened after. And I like to kind of think that what we experience now for Halloween, Studio had something to do. And the reason that I liked it was, first of all, everybody saw it as an opportunity to get in because everybody was wearing costumes. So we used to have the most outrageous costumes and the creativity from all the kids in the street, it was just unbelievable. And it's like your imagination was your own limitation by what you wanted to do, kind of creating that particular evening. We used to be inspired by Bosch. I remember one time we put like 3 tons of glitter on the floor, so you were in this kind of magical place, and people were finding glitter in their rugs 6 or 7 or 8 months, you know, after the event. There are lots of nights that are incredibly memorable for me. I remember, I suppose, the first night was probably within the 4 or 5 days of us opening. Halston had called up and wanted to have a party for Bianca Jagger. And so, you know, we scurried about and, you know, we got a white horse and, you know, we got a woman to be naked like Lady Godiva, and we painted clothes on her, and we painted clothes on a nude man and who led the horse in, and where they were bringing in the birthday cake. And I remember when they, you know, presented the birthday cake, Lady Godiva character got off and presented it to Bianca, and Bianca jumped up on a horse and so on and so forth. And then when that was done, I went home. So then I get a call the next morning from Steve in the morning that we were on the cover of the New York Post. And it was such an exhilarating time for him and for me, because that was the lifeblood of the business. You know, being in the newspapers, that was the way, you know, we created a lot of traction. You know, imagine a nightclub was on the cover of the New York Post. And I think that was a memorable time for me, and I have many others as well.
Oh, that was Ian Schrager, the co-founder of Studio 54, of course, the documentary about which we're discussing today. Jason, now the film made you think of another movie, and that is The Last Days of Disco by Whit Stillman.
I don't know, I'm not really a disco type. I probably wouldn't get in anyway.
Of course you'll get in. Holly's gorgeous.
This is from 1998. There was a little spate in the late 90s because there was actually a film called 54 in which Mike Myers played Steve Rebell, who's the partner of Ian Schrager, and I think Salma Hayek was in there. I mean, it had a kind of big, good soundtrack, and it wasn't a great movie. But Whit Stillman, who was one of those slightly, he's kind of a preppy guy, So he was more of the Graydon Carter, Vanity Fair kind of Tatler kind of type people. He ended up making this film called Last Days of Disco, which has become rather cultish as well. It was a film that starred Chloe Sevigny and Kate Beckinsale, and they were the sort of young New York girls who wanted to get into the club. They didn't name 54 as the place itself, but it was a Studio 54-esque place in their film.
Yeah.
And it really was called The Last Days of Disco, which this documentary, Studio 54, does sort of have. It had that scene, which is
end of an era,
kind of in Chicago, they blew up a box of disco records, said disco sucks.
Yeah.
They wanted to get rid of the disco. And that was, it's seen as a kind of massively homophobic gesture. I don't think anyone could complain about the massive tunes that are Thelma Houston or Candy Staten's Young Hearts Run Free. There's nothing wrong with those songs. You're not going to blow those up. Those are classics. But I think it was the culture that they wanted to blow, that exclusivity, that hedonism they wanted to blow. That was a kind of puritanical backlash. And I think Last Days of Disco captures that. And I think it's a great little performance from both Chloe Sevigny and Kate Beckinsale. Kate Beckinsale struggled to kind of match that. And Whit Stillman as well, as a filmmaker, he did Metropolitan, burst on the scene, and then Last Days of Disco, and then sort of didn't really kind of get himself together for many years. He came back recently with a film which reunited Chloe Sevigny and Kate Beckinsale in a British costume drama quite recently. But that one stands the test of time, Last Days of Disco. I think they still play it quite often. It's kind of requested quite a lot. I still see sort of certain nights of Last Days of Disco, and it captures that fantasy ec, probably like the last night that they kept in here, where Diana Ross, as you mentioned, Rob, sort of serenaded Rebel and Schrager off to prison with Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, brilliant.
And in that as well, I guess there's that idea of the exclusivity of it and the guys kind of being kind of, as you say, preppy kind of New York. They work in advertising or they work in banking and they want to get in, or they're just a bit square and a bit white, which didn't seem like it was probably a problem in that era.
And a bit trust fundy, as you mentioned. The trust funds did get in there. It's got the wonderful line in it, Last Days of Disco, which is like, well, I'd like to work in TV. I mean, I've been watching it my whole life. How difficult can it be? So quite often people quote that line still, and it is. It's kind of right there. And that entitlement, that sense of like, I can do this.
Yeah.
Maybe that works still. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe and a whole era of studying media studies was unleashed
because
on an
of
unsuspecting
that.
Populace.
Blame Beckinsale.
Yeah. Seth, you wanted to talk about, well, I've got it in my script, and maybe you can talk me through this. Hold my hand. Afrocosmic disco in Italy in the 70s.
It's a little bit like a different sort of like vibe, because this is like, it's more like attached to like underground vibe, like, you know, like could it be like, yeah, the Italian answer of Paradise Garage, actually. Uh-huh. So let's a little bit like change a little bit like the conversation about Studio 54 more like flashy. But yeah, like in the early 80s, like, you know, I grew up with this kind of music. Yeah, the genre was called Afro, but like Afro, because they was playing also African music, you know, they were playing Fela Kuti, Mano di Mango, stuff like that.
Like the Soul Makossa, which is in...
Yeah, no, complete, yeah. Exactly. Great, but then it was all like this Cosmic was a club open in 1981, in Garda Lake, and I'm originally from near the area, like, near Verona. So like, I never been to the club because I couldn't go because I'm underage, but there was a pirate radio station called Radio Azzurra, and they were broadcasting all the music, all the mixing from all these DJs.
That is good.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I was like such a, like, you know, in my bedroom, like completely like taping all this sort of like mix. Like, I got so many tapes, like, you know.
Can I just say to our listeners, we've got Sev here, legendary DJ, miming the playing record on his ghetto blaster.
And then I actually start mixing with my tape and the decks, because then when I started, I only had one decks, so like I was kind of like trying to mix together the tape with the decks, and it's not easy at all. So like that's like practice about it. And then like when my dad like bought me all the two decks, so it was like even way easier. But then again, not easy mixing all this kind of music, because this kind of music was all like live music, so not like 4/4 beats. So like it was all like keep it together. And again, music like African, but also Brazilian music. You know, I was playing records from George Ben and Gilberto Gil, you know, popular original bossa nova musician. But at the same time, also Cosmic, because it was like the beginning of electronic music, so Tangerine Dream, all of this kind of like weird German, well, German, but also English or whatever, like music. So it was a mix of everything. And the way like Daniele Baldelli, which was the main resident DJ, the Larry Levan of one of the Larry Levan of Italy, let's say like that, he was mixing in a kind of like way, like to pitch down some records, like completely like minus eight. So like some of the records, like the music was really, really, really slow, and maybe even the voice of the singer, like whoa, 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 like that, like very trippy, because you have to consider obviously like different era, 80s, different drugs as well.
So this is what disco became, and these were the influences flowing into it.
Yeah, the dark side of disco, you know. Disco, like in the, yeah, exactly. In the 70s, it was more like happy and fun, everything. And then the early 80s, it was getting a little bit dark. But yeah, it was really like, so that was my kind of music. But then at the same time, also they were throwing up some disco classic, but like this is slightly early 80s, so it's not really Studio 54, but it could be like a sort of Italian answer of Paradise Garage. You know, that's what we were doing, because obviously no internet, so they didn't know what they were playing in America, and the American, they didn't know what was happening in Italy.
How underground was that? What was the mainstream in Italy? Do you know what I mean? Were you like, I'm odd because everyone else is listening to Europe?
It was very, very underground. It was kind of like, actually, funny enough, like very like North Italy, beginning of border with Austria, like, you know, Alto Adige, Innsbruck. But then it was very underground. But then, like, recently, the last 10 years and so, like, all over the world, like, there's been this sort of, like, even more, even here in England with Harvey, DJ Harvey, 20 years ago, completely fascinated about these cosmic tapes and this cosmic music. So, like, there's been, like, all over the world now, like, people discovering this kind of, like, this kind of music, this kind of, the way Baldelli was DJ, you know, in a kind of, like, very strange, like, trippy, a little bit Italo disco, but not too Italo disco. It was all like a mix of everything.
And I associate it, it's interesting that it was in that kind of northern Italy, you're in Milan, Turin, even where you were from,
very
Verona,
different.
Up into Austria.
So who would go to this club in Lake Garda? I mean, not local residents, presumably.
There was kind of residents, but like lots of people that travel. Oh my God, actually, they were traveling from my hometown, which is Mantova, and it would be like, you know, let's say like 40 miles, and they were going by little scooter.
Of course.
Yeah, it was like...
film to be made. There's two films flowing.
There's the Northern Soul film they made in the UK, where people got on the bus to Wigan and all
and going with an umbrella, exactly.
And they did it on Vespers. It's warmer.
We started in Manhattan in late 1970s with Liza Minnelli and Truman Capote and Andy Warhol. We ended up on a bus.
In Garda Lake, on a bus.
We ended up in Garda and on a bus to Stoke.
On a little scooter, on a little Vespa.
This is good stuff. Please, let's get some funding together. I want to see these films made. That brings us to the end of the Monocle Culture Show. Studio 54 is showing in selected cinemas in the UK now. Thanks, of course, to my guests today, Jason Solomons and Severino Panzetta, and to my producer, of course, Holly Fisher. Next week, we'll be heading to the National Gallery for a new exhibition by Ed Ruscha, so do join us then. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.